Okay, welcome. We are, tonight is the sixth lecture of the 1500s. Tonight is December 30th. So we are in, I guess, Thanksgiving weekend. Not Thanksgiving, but New Year's weekend. Okay, so... we're continuing on just a little bit backtrack. We're really mainly into the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire, as we said before, is Hashem creates the refuah before the machla, and the Ottoman Empire was accepting the Jews with open arms. And any Jews that made it, whichever Jews made it there, was they found a home. Again, after, of course, coming to a new country with reestablishing yourself, new language, new place. But once they established themselves, it was very, very hospitable to the Jews. The only problem is when in 1492, Turkey was still at the other end of the world, so to speak. It was the other end of the Mediterranean Sea, and you had to get through a lot of places in order to get to the Ottomans and after the Jews came, so that really it was a growing empire, and the Jews just like precipitated that the growth. The Jewish talent, Jewish merchants, you know, the businesses, technology, like even munitions, like gunpowder, things that they learned from the Christians. They brought with them, and they taught the Ottomans. Suleiman and Selim, they both used gunpowder very, very much to their advantage to help them conquer more nations. Okay, so I think we are. Mehmed. So I wanted to start again. I know we may have touched on Mehmed. This is the Ottoman Empire. He was the conqueror from 1444 to 1445, 1451 to 1481. The reason why I guess we want to start with him is because he did something which was very, changed the world, so to speak, and that is that he conquered Constantinople. The Byzantine Empire, which was the heir, that was the of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire before it, at one point, it split into two parts. It was too big to be governed by one place, so they broke it up to the Western Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. Western Roman Empire was sacked by the German tribes, the Vandals, the Huns, and that was it. It was finished, and then that's European history. The Byzantine Empire never fell. And at one point, under Justinian, they really conquered a lot of the lands of the Western Empire, Western Roman Empire, and it probably would have lasted, except for the fact that the Muslims came up on the scene, and they swept the boards, and the Byzantines was a shadow of itself. But the Byzantines were around up until 1453. They kept losing lands in Asia Minor to the Ottomans. And then finally, in 1453, Mehmed made an attack on Constantinople. It was not a slam dunk that he would win. He had the men. He had like 10 times the amount of men. But Constantinople was very heavily fortified, like three layers of wall, its defense. They also say that they had some sort of a fire. It was like a liquid fire, a Greek fire. We have no idea what this was, but it's written down in all the books. They would throw this like liquid onto the boats, and it would catch on fire, right? And we have no idea what that was, or even how to make it. And I guess it was lost with the fall of Constantinople. So he finally conquered. When he conquered Constantinople, it was the official and total end of the Byzantine Empire.
Can I ask you a question? Why? It seems like he was ruling.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was 6 years. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened in those 6 years. But I think he was very young when he became emperor. So I'm not sure. And maybe is it like for a year, and then maybe there was like a power struggle. till he was able to come back. I really don't know. I don't notice that. But okay, in 1451, so 2 years later, 1453, he started off his career. He took out Constantinople. And the generals, at first, they were losing a lot of men. And like I mentioned before, the way they won the door, the way they won the war is somebody left the door open. Always lock your doors, you know. So that's basically really what happened. And then they had so many men that they got through that gate, and they overwhelmed them with so many men they couldn't kill them. And once you open one gate, you go around to open up all the gates. Basically, that's how they won the war. That's how they won. All right. Okay, he also gave in the beginning of his reign, as well as the others. Again, you may have seen this a little bit last time, but he put out a firman to all his, everybody in his empire, that they should, all the Jews are welcome to come into my capital. Again, this is 1453 to 1481. This is before the Spanish Inquisition. Before the Spanish Inquisition, but he opened it up to Jews. Again, it was an expanding empire. It wasn't too much past Asia Minor, which today is Turkey, which is not that. Wasn't too much in Europe or in the Middle East or North Africa. But he was building. He was growing. It was, the Jews were having a hard time in Europe. And he said, "Come, look, you know, whatever you're experiencing there." All the, anti-Semitism, that wasn't the word back then, but all the prejudicenesses and all the things that because of your religion you're not able to do, you're not able to, build or do. So come to my land. The choicest lands will be, you will prosper and flourish. And in fact, Jews from throughout the entire empire gathered like sand of the sea and they allocated land, and they started living there. One of the main things that they started doing, which the Jews at first were very wary of, because they were being done in Europe also, was that whenever they conquered a new area, they needed Jews there. So they actually forced Jews to move from one place to another. When they conquered Constantinople, they forced Jews from all over to move to Constantinople, especially since Mehmed wanted Constantinople to be the new capital of the Ottoman Empire. So if you want you need people there. If you wanted this to be your new capital, you wanted to populate it. So they may have even forced non-Jews, Ottomans also, to move there, but also Jews. And at first, the Jews were very wary. I mean, they're being forced. In Europe also, they're being constantly being forced to move out of there, exiled, forced to leave cities. Here, they're being forced to leave and being put to another place. But the difference here is that they're, take your money and take all everything with you and come here and, continue. Do what you can do. Do what you do best. This is Asia Minor. There's a good picture of Asia Minor. And all in the top left corner is where it says Istanbul, Constantinople. He changed it to Istanbul. So that's where the capital is today. If you notice, there's a very, very small area of water. It's very strategic, because if you wanted to get from the Black Sea, and below is the Aegean Sea, and below is the Mediterranean. So if you wanted it, that was like the land that controlled any type of movement of boats in and out, all the trades, any of the trade routes. If it came through the Black Sea, it had to go up through this area. So that was all controlled by Istanbul. That's probably why he wanted it to be the capital. It's also he's on the European side. In other words, that would be, this Turkey is Asia Minor, but it's part of Asia. And everything on the other side of the water, that's called Europe. So it's on the European continent, and they will conquer all the way into Hungary. We'll maybe yet to talk about that today. So the Ottoman Empire conquered way into Turkey. It's going to go all the way down where you see Syria, all the way down past Palestine, past the Middle East, into Egypt. Then it's going to make all the way around. It's going to go into North Africa as well. He gave him permission to build shuls, and he had like his three. I know we mentioned this last time. His three chief positions. He had a position which was for the Muslim, the Greek Orthodox, that was the Christian, and the rabbi. And this was filled, it was filled by Rav Moshe Kapsali, and we spoke about him last time. We'll speak about him again just now. Just this is like, again, he was very humble. He was a big Talmud Chacham, very, very ascetic type of a person, very holy. He studied Torah. He would sleep on the ground, nothing, no gashmias, only ruchnias. There were taxes that were placed on the community, three types of taxes. This is the poll tax. Poll tax, I think, is per person. There's the extraordinary tax in times of war, but that was like always. I think they were always at war. I don't think that they were ever too much of a period of time not in war. So that was always a time. And then there was the, if I'm saying it right, the Rab Akgeshi tax. Am I saying it right? Rab Akgeshi? So it was that was a rabbinical tax. That was a tax for the Jewish people collected by the chief rabbinate, and that was to help support the rabbi, and of course given over to the king, got his big cut from that as well. Okay, this is from the Divrei Yosef, Rav Yosef Sambari. He wrote this about 100 years in the 1650s, 1680s. So he's writing 100 years later. This is like he wrote like a little bit of a history. So he writes, and we mentioned this last time, I'll just go through it again. There was a plague that broke out in Asia Minor, and the Sultan Mehmed just wanted to know what it's for, and he calls up the Muslim, chief Muslim, Umam, whatever, what's it for? He doesn't know. The Christian, what is it for? Calls in Moshe Kapsali, says, why is God giving us a plague? And he said, because of promiscuity. Yeah, that's it. You know, Rayos, when there's promiscuity, that causes a plague. And he liked the answer, Mehmed. He says, I'm going to check into it. And sure enough, he checked into it, and he found that his janissary, how do you say it, the janissary, that was the, I guess, the Secret Service. Today, it probably would be called the Secret Service. This is the special, actually, it was the army, and from the army, they would take the elite that would be protecting of the Sultan. But this army was mainly filled from people of conquering lands, at least in the beginning. They conquer a land of Christians, they take a few of the men, the boys, and they bring them into the army. They would, I don't think that they would force them to become Muslims, but it was better off if they did, and more often than not they did. They were not allowed to have beards, and they were not allowed to get married. And they trained them how to do war, and they were treated very well. So, you know, at first they were very nervous to allow their children, I'm not talking about Jews, I'm talking about non-Jews, allow their children to become part of this janissary, because what are you doing to the kids? But afterwards they realized, they saw that these kids were being treated very well. They were training to be very, very good soldiers. And this is the soldier, he had like this is the standing army that they used to conquer more and more lands. And the more lands they conquered, the more kids they would take into the army. And I guess because they weren't allowed to marry, so they were morally corrupt. They were not watching themselves. So when the Sultan found out about this, he actually killed a number of them. And the chief rabbi also, like, that's scary, because the chief rabbi also did his investigation. And if he found that there were Jews that were also involved with the janissary, so he censured them, he punished them as well. I don't know how many Jews there were in that, but it does say that there were a few thousand janissary that were censured for this. Okay, 1453 was the fall of Constantinople. Again, this is another one of these maps where, in the very beginning, this was, so this dark green, light green was Sealand. So they didn't even have any of this yet. The dark green they had, you know, so they got a little bit up by Budapest, but mainly it was up here. So again, like we mentioned, in 1492, all this was still non-Ottoman. It took them a long time. It was a hard trip to get all the way through to the Ottoman Empire. Again, the Ottoman Empire in the 1600s, that's what it looked like. It was a big, big empire. And for like 400 years, 400-500 years, that was the that was what the empire was. Okay, just keep Bayazid. He was the emperor. He was the sultan when in 1492 he became in 1481. Again, he extended the empire. Also into Europe, his went all the way. I think Bayazid. No, he did not go all the way. But that dark is going to be Suleiman. So he extended the empire into Europe and added outposts to the Black Sea. Now he put down revolts in Asia Minor, and he was the first one that turned the Ottoman fleet into a major naval power. In 1492, he had a doctor. I have him, the doctor, at the end, but his doctor was Moshe Harmon. And actually his doctor was, it's either Yosef Harmon, who was his doctor. Yosef Harmon was on his way to the Holy Land, and he was picked up by, he was happened to be in the passing by wherever the capital was at the time, probably Istanbul, right? And what happened is the Sultan saw him, and he was a good doctor, and they said, you're working for us now. And he became the doctor of the Sultan. He wielded a lot of influence. His son Moshe Harmon became the doctor under Bayazid and Suleiman. So Moshe Harmon had a tremendous influence. He's a brilliant doctor. He's probably Talmud Chacham too, and gave him a lot of advice. And when in 1492 he convinced Bayazid to send boats to Spain to pick up Jews, and they did. And so, again, how many Jews could you pick up, and you know how many boats did they have? But they picked up, and they brought to the Ottomans. Bayazid is also known. I don't think I have the quote here, but Bayazid is known to say, they call Ferdinand smart. He was the one that said it. They call Ferdinand smart. He enriches our country by sending us his Jews. He makes his country poor, and he makes our country rich by sending us all the Jews. He was like quoted as saying that. You're right. You're mistaken to call Ferdinand smart, for he makes his country poor by throwing out the Jews and sending us his Jews. Along those lines, that was his quote. So 1481, 1512, he's still building by the end of his empire. Yes, the empire is already in North Africa and has already moved into Europe, all closer to Spain. So now when the conversos, when the Anusim, they start leaving, they have a lot easier journey. You know, first of all, they could choose the boats that the ships that they want. They're not at the mercy of these these pirates. But the seas are, there's a lot. The Ottoman Empire extended into North Africa, much closer already to Spain and Portugal. Rav Elio Mizrahi. So after Rav Moshe Kapsali passed away, Rav Elio Mizrahi became the chief rabbi. Now, who is Rav Elio Mizrahi? We all know, I mean, many of us know, we probably all should know, anybody ever is yeshivas or seminary especially, the Mizrahi. Yeah, everybody like a parish on Rashi, right? Everybody done that. He made a parish on Rashi explaining what like Rashi's underlying question on everything is. Like Rashi is Pashat Pshat in the Chumash, right? That's where Rashi. But how do you see Pashat Pshat? He brings all these midrashim, and sometimes Rashi brings two different pshatim. So like the Sifsei Chachamim and the Mizrahi, what he has done is he made a parish on Rashi explaining why Rashi chose this parish, how Rashi sees it in the Chumash, what words sparked Rashi to say what he said, and that was done by Eliyahu Mizrahi. So he had he made his sefer. He has in there the Gorarie, the which is the Maral. I know Sifsei Chacham, and they put all these like four or five Mefarshim together. But that's who the Mizrahi was. So he became the chief rabbi, and this is in 1492 now. So now he's in charge, and he realizes that something's got to be done for the Jews, because that's it. 1492, they're all kicked out. He has tremendous influence with the Sultan Bayazid, and he says to the, please send like a ferment, make an announcement, which Bayazid does. He sends the message, a ferment, to all of his governors, take in all the Jews with open arms. Don't like give them any difficulties or anything. And that's what they did. He writes that if any refugee from Spain, that he writes anybody, this is in a tshuva of his, in Sefer Tshuva in 66, tshuva, he says, all those expelled from Spain received honor from me, and according to my ability, I serve many services for them. For almost a year, I toiled on behalf to collect funds, many hundreds of florins, to free those that were taken captive. Of course, everywhere they went, boats and pirates, they took them, and they ransomed them off, and Eliyahu Mizrahi was instrumental in redeeming, buying back as many captives as he could. He writes in the same tshuva, I became embroiled in terrible controversy with all the Jewish communities as I gathered on behalf of the Spanish exiles. On three or four occasions, close to 3,000 florins, whatever the thing is, you just have to keep collecting money. In the process, I excommunicated many wealthy members of the community because they refused to contribute the amount that I had asked of them. So here it is. He keeps coming, knocking on the doors. We need more money. There are more refugees. And he used a considerable amount of his own money. I even put my own life in danger. He said that he was never, he was very weak physically. He wasn't such a strong person. He says, on the immense pressure, constant strain, besides the fact that he was running a yeshiva, he says, in addition to the sacrifice of almost a year lost of study and research.
What did text communication mean for those people?
Well, it probably meant a lot more than it means today. It means today there, I know that in Europe it meant that you can't be married or buried or you're nothing. If they're in excommunication,
you couldn't continue being Jewish,
but he was the chief rabbi, so maybe he had a lot more control over the entire country. But excommunication was a tremendous weapon, and people wouldn't talk to you, he wouldn't do business with you. I mean, if it was really done well, it could have been. It's very hard to overcome that, especially when here in America. So I don't, I have non-Jews. I can do anything. It's such a free society. You can't even imagine what you do for a cherem. So you can't daven in your shul, so we'll go to another shul. You tell the old people in the neighborhood, we'll go to a different state, a different country.
I think it was a little more than that, because anyone who had a position who was doing something and he excommunicated them, there were more people coming in who needed things to do. So whatever business or thing that they were doing,
sure,
he has more people to put in okay, trained to do what he was doing.
Sure. He also probably had probably some temporal powers. He was probably able to, put in jail or flog, or maybe even, I don't know if he had the ability to kill, capital punishment. But so, I know in Europe it was like that. I'm assuming in the Ottoman Empire was similar, but that's what he's writes. Here is like very trying times, emergency funds, people are coming, for that year or two that people were all over and they were lost and they were being captured and they had to be resettled. Even if they made it, they came penniless. They were not allowed to even bring money with them. So that he writes also, This is also in a different tshuva. Rabbi Elio Mizrahi writes, many burdens and difficulties, one after another. First of all, he had his own family, providing family for small children. He had to provide a dowry for his daughter, 600 florins. I guess some things don't change, you know, it's florins or dollars or whatever. He had also to deal with members, and he wasn't, he created a lot of, I wouldn't say enemies, but antagonists, you know, for everything that he had to do. Then he had his yeshiva. So he writes, and he's responsible for the yeshivas. I it's like hard to understand what the yeshiva was there, but people sent him boys to the yeshiva, and he didn't really want to accept everybody, but they put pressure on him, and he had to accept other people. And beyond, you know, he said, now this is, I guess you learn from his tshuvas, but this extends beyond the study of Gemara. I am forced to teach each student a particular subject that interests him. One of them wishes to study logic, okay? Or another wishes to study fractions, another arithmetic. And every day the subjects change. It seems that kid came in one day, okay, I want to teach me fractions, or teach me, you know, science. I don't know. I want to know about history. It seems that almost, and like, seems strange. I mean, he's Rosh Yeshiva. I'm here to teach Gemara. If you want to learn math, just, like, go next door to the... But I guess that was part of his, and he writes over here, this is where he says he's fragile by nature, and it's very hard. Rarely a month goes by where he's not completely overcome by fatigue for at least a day or two. This is in his Tshuva 56. He writes something else also in that same Tshuva, which is very interesting, that you see even in his time, Karaites. There were still Karaites around. I mean, there may even still be now, but he writes, those who could teach Karaites or attempting to bring them under the wings of divine presence is no greater mitzvah. These Karaites are not the original heretics who denied the validity of Torah Shabbat Peh, but their distant descendants. Close to 1,000 years has elapsed since the beginning of the movement. These descendants are akin to children who were kidnapped and raised by Gentiles. What do they call it? They call them Tinuk Shenishbar. And raised by Gentiles, whose memory of true Judaism has been completely submerged. So he writes again, if you're able to help out and be makari of these Karaites, you know, it's a mitzvah. This is a tshuva from the Marshtam. So we mentioned before last week where there were lots of people moving around in the Ottoman Empire. Okay, so first of all, you had your what they call the Ramanot. Romanot were the Greek Jews, the Jews that were living under the Greeks, under the Byzantines, and in Europe under the different countries, Bosnia and Greece and even Hungary, Bulgaria, or whatever the countries were there. So you had Jews there. So they were called Romaniot. These were mainly Ashkenazic Jews. And then you had, so they were conquered by the Ottomans, and the Ottomans would take Spanish Jews or Jews from other areas, and before Spanish Jews, and they would move them into different cities because, again, as they conquered a new city, they wanted these cities to become big cities and viable cities that could work for the empire in different areas. They were constantly moving people around. Then you had your refugees from Spain coming. So now you had Spanish refugees along with people that were originally in a city and other Jews from other cities coming in. So you could have a city now that is, the makeup of the city is totally different. Now the Ottomans did allow each kahila to have different kahilas. I think maybe we'll see in like the 1800s of Europe, in Germany, they were very strict. If you wanted to have your own kahila, it wasn't so pashut. This is something that, like, Shamshel Froel Hirsch had to fight for. You know, all the kahilas were all reform kahilas, and Shamshel Froel Hirsch had to fight to get his own kahila, special permission from the government to have your own kahila, your own shul, your own mikvah, your everything. But here the Ottomans, they didn't mind. Each Jew could have their own shul, their own place. That was not an issue. But you could have now cities that were coming together, and you have different Jews, or, you know, from different areas. Now, what could happen is you can get some halachic shilas. So this is the tshuva that was given to the Marshtam. And this happened to be in a city called Sofia, which I think is today in Bulgaria. right? Am I Sophia? Yes. Capital of Bulgaria, Sophia. Okay. So the Ashkenazim, you had Ashkenazim there. You had Ashkenazim mainly are from European Jews. You had the Romaniot, which were the Greek Jews. And you had Sephardim, who came from Sfat. Okay, you can see a nice mixture for a nice, like, I guess, a mini-series. So what happened here? They all originally, and then, so the Turks took over, and now they're all there. So they here lived under the domination of the Turkish king. May his majesty be exalted. And they were all accustomed to eating meat according to the great, well-known authorities, the Rif, the Rambam, Ramban, Rashba, Rosh, Balaturim. Okay, so they had a certain way of that they ate meat. Now, when the king, may his majesty be exalted, conquered the kingdom of Hungary in 1516, okay, so the king brought them and settled many of them in the above city of Sofia. So he wanted to take the Jews that he, maybe, I guess there was a very, very big community in Hungary, and he wanted to build up the community in Sofia, so he brought a lot of Hungarians to the city of Sofia. Okay, so their custom regarding inspection of animal shlita was unlike that of our the Jews that were there. Unlike, it seems that the other three were all pretty much similar. The Sephardim, the Romaniot, and the Ashkenazim were a little different than the Hungarians. They were overly strict in comparison to the above authorities in some areas and excessively lenient in others. Okay, so now, as the Hungarian immigrants became the majority population, the whole city began to act in accordance to Hungarian customs. So now, all these other Jews that were there used to have a certain way of dealing with their meats, and now the Hungarians came, and they had a lot of chumras in one area and kulas in the other area. One kula that they had, the Hungarians, is like I guess we sort of have it today, is they would blow. We have what's called glot meat. What's glot meat? Glot meat is when you take a look at the lungs, there are no sirchos, there are no like lesions on the lungs. Okay, because we're always afraid. If there's a hole in the lung, it's a treif. And we're afraid if there's a lesion on the lung, there really is a hole there, right? So if you want, if you're buying glot kosher means that there was no lesions on the lung. Now there's a machlokus in the poskim. What happens if there are lesions? So what some opinions say that's it, no good, because maybe there's a hole. Other opinions say you could do the following. You blow up the lung, okay, and then with the lesions, you blow it up, and then you put the lung in water. And if there's a hole, you'll see bubbles coming up. So some hold of it, some don't hold of it. The Hungarians held of it. That was one of their coolers. And they had other chumers that they had that the other Jews didn't have. But what happened is since then, okay, by the way, there's Hungary, and there's, you're right, Bulgaria, Sofia, and they were moved by the Ottomans from Budapest, I don't know if that's where Budapest is, but from areas in Hungary to Sofia. So then, okay, finally the Hungarians were then sent from Sofia to a different, where they, on their own, they moved to another city, Kavalia. I don't know where that is. Anybody? Kavalia? Okay. So however, what happened is the Hungarians left, but they kept doing what they were doing while the Hungarians were there. And it didn't bother anybody. Why? Because the Ottomans allowed the Jews to use their shchita houses. See, even today, the Arabs have what they call halal. What do they call it? The halal kosher. They have some sort of a kosher meat, and I think our shchita is good for them, yeah. Right? So they will allow our shchita. So once the Jews were using the shchita of the shlacht house of the Ottomans, it wasn't a big deal because if anything was treif, they just sold it to the Turks, and that was it. No problem, you know. So there was very little loss of money. So you sell it to them for a drop cheaper, but there's very little risk involved. And what happened since then is that the Turks did not allow the Jews to use their schlachthaus. So what then would happen is if the Jews would shecht, so, and if there was a problem, if something wasn't kosher, then somehow I guess they wouldn't be able to easily sell it to the Turks. And it would be a big loss if it wasn't kosher. So the shaila they sent to the Marshtam is, what do we do? First of all, twofold shaila. First of all, the chumras that we, and the sheikhim didn't want to shech now because they're going to lose a lot of money if you know, they're very, you know, careful. They're afraid to shech because you shech and there's a problem. So they want to know, first of all, the chumras that the Hungarians brought with them, do they need to keep those chumras? Can they get rid of those chumras? And secondly is the coolers about like blowing up their lungs that the Hungarians brought with them, could we keep that? So could we keep our coolers and their coolers? And that was really the shaila that was asked of the Marashtam. And basically he answers that, he says like this, he says, the chumras that they took on, basically his answer is you don't have to, you don't, it's okay, you don't have to keep those. You don't even have to do a Hataras Nedarim, because it's not something you took upon yourself actively. It just happened. He says it is better, though, to get three people not from your city and to do Hataras Nedarim to them anyway. That's still better. He says, as for your other shaila taking on their kulas, no. He says, nah, that's it. There are enough people that don't allow that practice, so that you should keep your chumras, but you don't have to keep their chumras. So I guess they got halfway. But it's a very, very interesting shaila that came out because everybody's moving, and this is just another similar shaila. Okay, you allow. Okay, this is what I just spoke. Here's another shaila with davening, with the sitter. So again, you had the Ramaniot. They had a certain way of davening. And then you had, different communities. Again, you know, it wasn't. I would imagine up for the since this time period, the Jews weren't so mobile. It doesn't look like that. You know, you're moving all over the world. They just, you know, you're in an area. So each area started to have their own like little different customs and how to daven and what to say and everything. And again, what happened is a certain community, they ended up with, you know, so many different Jews. So, you know, I guess if they couldn't afford so many different shuls, they had to daven together. So what nusach do you take on? So what he writes over here, the Marashtam, what happened is that certain community, the sitter was arranged in a certain manner according to the way they used to do it. But in the course of time, through migrations, again, people are moving from one city to another city, the refugees from Spain are coming. So it seems that everybody started to take upon themselves this Sephardic mode of prayer. It seems that the Sephardim, wherever they came, they took over. It's like in the Ottomans. You know, they had all these Jews here, but they were a very proud people, very strong customs, and they held themselves like higher, you know, in terms of education, broad secular education, and it was so they took their, many of the areas took upon themselves. It says very good. They used to take on the Sephardic mode of prayer, most of them, because it's made up the majority in the kingdom. It seems that in certain areas, most of the Jews now became Sephardim. And their form of praying is clear and sweet. As a result, nearly all of them have forsaken their own customs and follow the Sephardim custom. That is the case in the major city of Salonika, where the members of the former communities of Calabria, Provence, Sicily, Apulia, these are also from Italy, from France, from South France, they were all exiled also, and they all came with their own method, their own tefillos, their nusachs, and they all came for the Sephardic. It seems that only the Ashkenazim, I guess they were just as stubborn as the Sephardim, they kept their nusach. So the Ashkenazim, besides the Ashkenazim, all of the other places, they all started to adapt the Sephardic custom, and he asked, what should we do? Should we really take on this new Sephardic custom, or we have a Mesorah to daven the way we always davened? So the Marashtam, interesting tshuva, he writes, he says, even though it's normally correct and probably mandated to keep one's ancestral custom, in other words, if you were always daven a certain way to keep that, in this situation regarding prayer, it's not the case. It's proper to assume the Sephardic mode of prayer. I think, I don't know if he holds that it was a clearer, like a, for whatever reason, he says, you should all switch to the Sephardic. So the Svardim, you know, a lot of the people, it just became like swept the boards. As part of the Ashkenazim, that they, so you basically now had mainly two, Sephardic and Ashkenazim, different types of tefillahs. I guess back in home in Morocco, you still had the Moroccan way of davening, and in Egypt, you still had the Moroccan. What's the Nesach you daven? Regular Sephardic? Huh?
Yishalmi.
Okay, so it says. Okay, so different, still different customs that are around, but it seems that, again, another interesting. Now, there was a city, one of the major cities that became a major Jewish center was Salonika. This became like the major city in terms of learning, in terms of shuls, in terms of Jewish character of the city. I think it ended up that in Salonika, they didn't do any business. It became Shabbos was the day off because there were so many Jews there. Salonika, the great city, population mainly Jewish, yeshiva, Torah study unparalleled without a doubt. So this is a Shaila from the Marshtam. He is somebody who was in Skopje, in Macedonia. Macedonia is in Greece. Should he move to Salonika? He says, absolutely. That's the place to go. Another tshuva from Marshtam. As far as we know, there is no place in the Gulls with such a large group of Torah scholars. The Holy Torah Study group of Salonika exceeds all in quantity as well as quality. Again, the Marshtam, Yerodea 158. Another one, Rabbi Yaakov Ibn Chaviv. I think Rabbi Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, if I'm not mistaken, he is the one who wrote the Ein Yaakov. He was actually from Spain. He went through Portugal, and him and his son, Gershon, became the Rav of Yerushalayim at the same time as Yaakov Bey Rav and the Beis Yosef was in Sfat. So he was the one that wrote the Ein Yaakov. He wrote that at present, this kingdom does not give us the permission to designate specific. Interesting, it seems that at some point the Turks were cut back on religious freedom. It does not give us permission to designate a specific house, permanent use as a synagogue. We don't have permission to build a new one. And we go to basements and we have to daven quietly. Okay, there's a Rav Yosef Taitchik, I'm not sure how to say his name, but also he has also tshuvas. He says he's writing to, is a Rav Shlomo Levi Chakan, and basically he says, who are you? So Rav Taitchik says, even if you don't know who I am, why don't you ask the esteemed Rav Levi Ibn Chaviv? I think maybe not Gershon, Levi was the son of Rav Yaakov. We lived together for over 25 years. In addition, what about Yaakov Beirav, who approved of my tshuvos? Rav Yaakov Beirav is known. He was like the leader, one of the leading of the generation. He was the Rebbe, one of the Rebbeim of Rav Yosef Cairo. So that's where Rav Yaakov, that's the level that Rav Yaakov Beirav was. Okay, so he says, and he writes, the light of Israel, its sanctity, the crown of exile, among the neighbor Rosh Yeshiva. So this is what Rav Yosef Cairo wrote about Rav Yosef Taitchik, I think, who was in Salonika at the time. He also shows the esteem that Rav Yosef Cairo had for Rav Yosef Taitchik. And I heard that for 40 years, the savior Rav Yosef Taitchik only slept on a regular bed. It says that he slept his feet over a large chest. He would wake up at midnight. Nobody even knew this until after his death, his wife told us. Okay. Am I going in the right direction? So he writes also about Salonika and more than 40 years in which I am studying in one of the most prestigious yeshivas in the Turkish Empire. The last 15 years, there was no yeshiva throughout the empire that compared to this one, either in wisdom or numbers. Throughout the Romaniote, again, these are the Greek Jews, original Jews that were in Greek before the Ottomans were there. My teachings resound. I have more than 20 close disciples who head their own yeshivas and halachic rulings. Okay? I have not seen or heard any... It also seems this concludes the explanatory treatise on the workings of the astrolabe. So it seems, besides being a Talmud Chacham, he was a scientist, or he's an astrologist. And the astrolabe was an instrument used to measure where you were, like for boats and ships going on the high seas. So you're able to measure with stars where you were. So he was telling people how that worked. Did he make it? I'm not sure. I don't think it was his base. Okay. Then just the golden age, we're talking Selim. Selim continues. He's after Mehmed, 512 to 520. During his time, he conquers the Middle East. In 1516, Yerushalayim is conquered. 1516, 1517, he conquers all the way through Egypt. 1516, Ottoman Empire replaces the Mamluks. Mamluks were another Arab tribe that was in Israel at the time. He defeats in Aleppo, which is Syria, and the battle in Gaza. 1517, makes a pilgrimage to Yerushalayim, and he finally makes his way to Cairo in 1517, and that's it. No more Mamluks. 1518, okay, this is the history of Yerushalayim. The Abu Ghosh clan goes to Yerushalayim to restore order. And in 1535, 1538, so this is before, this is, I guess we'll get to Suleiman the Magnificent, but he rebuilds the walls in 1535-38. Okay, in 1546, there was a earthquake in Yerushalayim. But okay, getting back, Suleiman. Suleiman, he's called, this is it, the golden age. This is it after, the zenith of the Ottoman Empire, which is Suleiman, 1520-1566. In 1516, 1517, they conquered Yerushalayim. And then in 1517, 1518, the first years after Selim passed away in the beginning of Suleiman, so the governors rebelled. And in the Middle East, that's it. All the governors rebelled against the Ottoman Empire, and Suleiman came in 1520, and that's it. He just, like, you know, changed all the governors, and he made sure that didn't happen again. 1521, Belgrade, Rhodes, 1522, broke the military power of Hungary, waged three campaigns against Persia. I mean, if this is like all over the world. You're going from the West into Europe, all the way into Persia. He was also justice, harmony. He made it arts, philosophy, writing. He actually even wrote poetry himself. He was a big patron of the arts. So I guess this also fits in very nicely with the Renaissance, thank you. With the Renaissance. So I guess it was a Renaissance, I guess it was the whole world thing in the 1500s. The Renaissance, we'll talk about it more when we get to European history. But I guess you see it's fitting that all during the Ottoman Empire also there was a Renaissance of art, of writing, music. Okay. One of the things we have today from Suleiman is the old walls, the old city walls. There were no walls around Yerushalayim, and they were broken in many parts. And he was the one. The present day walls are the ones built by Suleiman the Magnificent. He built them. He hired these two contractors to build them. So they built the walls mainly. If you take a look at certain rounds, you go around the walls. Certain times you'll see different type of stones on the bottom. So most of the walls he built, I don't think most of it, there were already walls there from a previous time. Sometimes you could even see as early as the Hashmonaim walls. You know, I guess based on the type of stones, you could tell who built them. He shortcutted, the architects, the contractors, as time immortal, shortchanged Suleiman, and he did not include what today we have as the City of David. So instead, he just followed a wall that was there, and that's where Sharashpa is. So he made the wall, instead of going all the way down and encompassing what today is City of David, Ir David, he cut it short. So Ashpa is Ashpa, and everything is outside the city. So in his banquet, you know, for, you know, on the, I guess, the Chanukah Chanukah Sa'ir, Chanukah Sa'wukaisel, Chanukah walls, he had a big party, and he invited, you know, with the two architects, and for their reward, he killed them. I guess he killed them. That's for different reasons why I heard. One is that he shortchanged them. I wanted walls. I wanted the, you know, maybe even Har Tzion should have been in the walls also, but he did not include Ir David in the walls.
Huh?
Others say that they killed him because it's such a beautiful city. I didn't want him to build it anywhere else. You heard that story? Oh, you don't want to pay the bill. Anyway, if you want to know where these two architects are buried, you can use. I'm sure you've passed them.
Temple Mount is not Har Tzion.
Temple Mount is not Har Tzion. No. Shar Tzion is the diaspora yeshiva there now, where the old supper is. Kever David HaMelech. That's all on Har Tzion.
That's
also outside. It could be he wanted that included in. You know, maybe. You could have done one without the other, you know, because there's one mountain here, and there's a valley, and then you have Har Tzion, there's a different mountain. But both of them were not included. So, you know, some say he killed them because he shortchanged them, they shortchanged him, or some say is that I don't want him to, or he didn't want to pay the bill, whatever. But if you want to see their graves,
huh? It was an argument.
Yeah,
they had a disagreement somehow, some way.
Right, so it depends how, whatever story you want to believe, but if you want to see where they're buried, as soon as you walk in today, you go in Shar Yaffa, okay? When you walk in the city on Shar Yaffa, just look to your left, you'll see two graves. That's where they are. That's where they're buried. Just an interesting story with Shar Ashba and Suleiman. So Suleiman is in Yerushalayim, and he sees this lady bringing garbage, I guess, through Shar Yaffa, and through Shar Ashba, that's where it got its name. He's bringing garbage and throwing the garbage like around where the coastal area is. And he says to her, what are you doing? She says, well, I'm throwing garbage here. And he says to her, why are you throwing garbage here? She says, because my parents threw garbage here, and their parents threw garbage here. He says, why are they throwing garbage here? He says, well, this used to be the holy temple of the Jewish people, and that's where we throw our garbage. Hence the name Shar Ashba, because that's where they used to bring the garbage in. And he told her, if you do it again, I will probably have your head handed to you. So I don't know if she did it again, but it was a custom, just to see that the custom in the 1530s, that the... they're still throwing garbage by the Kotel area. There's a story with Moses Montefiore in his day made like 5 trips. In the early 1800s, his last trip was in the late 1800s. First trip, he spent like 3 months getting there, 2-3 months getting back, and he spent like a week there, 2 weeks in Yerushalayim. In one of his trips, I don't know if it was his first one or his second trip, the story goes is he wanted to clear up the area by the Kotel. But like to pay people and there's so much garbage and everything and to dig and it was just too much. So one day he goes in the morning and he takes a few Napoleon coins, big gold coins, and he throws it all around. Just a few coins, day one. And the Arabs find out that there are Napoleons there. So the Arabs start going and start digging and digging and digging and they find the coins and they go home. So then Moses Montefiore hires a guy to take away the garbage. The next day he comes back again with more gold coins and he throws a few more gold coins. They come back again. They start digging more and more and more. And then that's, you know, until they finally dug out, you know, and it's, I don't know if he did it a few times or whatever, but that's the way the story goes, that he cleared off a certain area. And that's how he did it, with just throwing gold coins in the area. But that's like in the 1800s. That's like 300 years from now. But this is what we have. If you ever want to know what we have from Suleiman, this is this is today's. And this was the city. And everybody who lived here lived in the city of Yerushalayim up until the mid-1800s. The mid-1800s is finally, they started to build little communities outside the old city. It was dangerous outside the city. You had these roving Arab bands. The Ottoman Empire, after Suleiman, would have a slow decline. And it would be it's like a slow death. And I think finally, most of the time, okay, I want to just, will, okay, I guess I could just, Moses Hamon, not Harmon, Hamon, that was the doctor for Bayazid. Yosef was for Bayazid and for, I had it wrong before, I think. Yosef, his father, Yosef Hamon was for Bayazid and Selam, and then his son Moshe was for Selam and Suleiman, and it was Moshe Hamon, very influential. For example, there happened to have been a blood libel somewhere in the lands conquered by the Ottomans. And Moshe Hamon had Suleiman issue a declaration that if there is ever such a blood libel, it cannot be tried by any court except mine. Because he knew these courts were all biased and they were just going to kill Jews. But to have that being able to send out by Suleiman, the emperor, was because of his influence that he had with this doctor. Okay, I think we'll end it here. We'll just continue. I want to maybe next week we can go to the talk about some other very interesting people. David Ruveni, if anybody heard of Shlomo Molcho, Donna Gracia, her son-in-law and nephew, Don Nasi, very interesting people at this time that was happening, things that were happening all over the, and then eventually we're going to go to this spot. We're going to talk about the Smicha controversy. Right, any questions?